Chapter 6, Blended. I fell in love with a man who was already a father. It never occurred to me that parenting somebody else's child would be difficult, especially considering that was the only family model I knew. In May of 1990, I drove my black Volkswagen Scirocco into the driveway of the large pale yellow house divided into four apartments, two up and two down. My apartment was on the ground level, facing the end of a shared driveway and a patch of yard that contained a swing set. I noticed my neighbor playing on the swing set with his son. My eyes fixated on his brother, Mark, who was visiting them. His dark hair and beard reminded me of Randy Owen, the lead singer of Alabama. They really don't look alike, but I have a habit of associating people with famous musicians. I was super into hair back then, facial hair, long hair, and even body hair, and those blue eyes, think Elvis's face and Tom Selleck's build combined. As I exited my car, I saw my roommate eyeing Mark from the doorway, commenting that he was good-looking. Before she had an opportunity, I dropped my book bag and found myself quickly walking past my roommate to introduce myself to Mark. His brother would later tell him, "She likes you." "Why do you say that?" Mark would inquire. "Because she never gives me the time of day, and I live next door." Mark was familiar to me because his ex-wife, Debbie, used to live in the same apartment that his brother had moved into. Back then, I would occasionally wave at Mark as I was pulling in and out of the shared driveway. He would be standing at Debbie's door to pick up his two-year-old daughter, Kimberly, for visitation and would wave back. That was the extent of our interactions. My front door butted up to Debbie's front door, and sometimes Kimberly would wave at me when I would come out to grab my mail. I often heard Debbie's angry voice penetrating our mutual wall and felt sorry for her kid, having such an angry mother. Debbie had left some items in the apartment when she abruptly moved out. Inside a drawer were her high school report cards containing mostly D's and F's. Mark's brother found this highly amusing, considering that Debbie had an annoying habit of trying to make everyone in his family feel dumb. In a closet hung one article of clothing, a blue wedding dress. I found it bizarre she left it hanging there all by itself, but it was clear she wanted to send a message. Debbie wore it the day that she and Mark married before the Justice of the Peace, with Kimberly's birth imminent. I was drawn to Mark for many reasons, but it was clear that he fit in with the ideal father image that I had cobbled together growing up without any emotional validation from Max. Just coming out of an abusive relationship and not receiving any counseling to work through the issues that led me there to begin with, I carried multiple traumas into our relationship. Mark was older and worldly, and he had an excellent work ethic coupled with high sensitivity and intuition. His biggest flaw was his temper. He never tried to hide it. In fact, I witnessed it early on whenever Debbie's name would come up in conversation. Their relationship was toxic. As I did in my past relationships with men, I ignored the signs of impending danger. Mark tried his best to convince me that I did not want to be married to a divorced father. A single childless woman, he felt I deserved someone with less baggage. I refused to listen to that and forged full steam ahead. My biggest flaw was my naivete. Although I did not judge him for being divorced and I loved kids, I deeply underestimated the uphill battle that was to come. Mark spent many evenings at my apartment, bantering with my roommate or helping me study for a college class. We made frequent trips to Friendly's restaurant for hot fudge sundaes and walnuts. Prior to meeting Mark, I had decided to leave Ohio with my mom, who was planning to move east. I had been accepted into a college, had transferred my credits from Wright State University, and I was excited to live close to Ocean City, our favorite family vacation spot. But that fall, Mark and I were engaged and planning a wedding for the following June. My mom was disappointed that I would not be moving east and was concerned about my plans to marry. She envisioned a different path for me, one that did not include helping to raise another woman's child. In response, she spoke with my fiancé one-on-one when I was out of town. I was unaware of her plan and furious that she went behind my back. I'm not sure if she was hoping to scare him away, but by the end of their discussion, she quickly realized that wasn't going to happen. Mark humored her and satisfied her anxieties for the time being. None of my friends were stepmoms. In fact, I did not know anybody who was. Pre-internet, I fumbled through my new role as best I could. There weren't many resources back in the early 90s, but kids always liked me. How hard could it be? A decade younger than Kimberly's dad, I was like a big kid anyway, always trying to figure out what the next adventure would be. Camping? Kings Island? Swimming? We did it all, and I learned that being a mom really suited me. When Kimberly would visit, she was like my constant shadow. She wore her light, wavy brown hair all the way past her bottom. She had the signature grub blue eyes with the long black eyelashes. Her ears were pierced when she was an infant, which is the thing to do during the 80s. I had noticed over time that the backs of her ears were crusty and infected looking. During one visit, I removed Kimberly's earrings to clean her earlobes and earrings with rubbing alcohol. I carefully packed the earrings to be sent back home. Very soon after that, a letter from Debbie's lawyer arrived advising I had no right to remove Kimberly's earrings and claiming that the ear holes had closed. It was becoming clear that being part of Mark and Kimberly's life would mean also being part of Debbie's life. Debbie was sending the message that she was not pleased that she would have to share her daughter with another woman. Not raised in a divorced household myself, I was at a loss. And like most young women my age, raised in a sheltered environment and fed a steady diet of Disney, I believed love would conquer all. My fantasies about how this was going to go soon came to an end when it became clear, relatively early on, that Debbie liked me even less than she liked Mark. She was upping her game, so much so that it became apparent that Mark was going to have to hire an attorney. We found Jerry, a tough, female, no-nonsense attorney who came highly recommended. She saw Mark's case as a no-brainer and filed a post-decree motion requesting court-ordered visitation, something that was not spelled out in the original divorce decree. If successful, the standard court order of visitation would enable Kimberly to visit our house every other weekend and 4 weeks in the summer. At that time, Debbie was not permitting Kimberly to stay overnight with Mark, coming up with a multitude of excuses. Having regularly scheduled visits would be a big improvement and we hoped would cut down on the number of arguments. At family court, clients congregate with their attorneys in a large hallway containing long rows of chairs. One by one, as each case is called, only the direct parties go into a private room with counsel to join the magistrate. This process would become familiar to Mark as he would return again and again. A few months after our wedding, with no forewarning, Debbie remarried and moved Kimberly out of Dayton to Columbus. She refused to give Mark the name of her new husband, and Mark was forbidden to meet him. It would be a full decade later before we would come face-to-face with Kimberly's stepfather during her grandmother's funeral. At every court hearing to come, Debbie would try to convince her attorney and the magistrate that Mark was not a good parent. Over the coming years, she would refuse to cooperate in sharing information. Kimberly had multiple oral surgeries that we knew nothing about beforehand. Mark missed school performances, dance recitals, First Communion, and confirmation. In present time, the situation would be labeled parental alienation. However, this was not something that was well understood in the 1990s. Parental alienation is when one parent intentionally displays unjustified negativity in order to damage the child's relationship with the other parent. This can happen in high-conflict divorces where one or both parties are high in narcissism. All we really understood back then was that Debbie liked to keep drama stirred up as often as possible. Obviously, this was not even close to an ideal situation for any of us. Mark felt helpless as a father to protect Kimberly from the emotional fallout of his divorce. He also had resigned himself to forfeit attending certain events because it only increased the maltreatment that Kimberly received from her mother. Mark felt terrible that I was exposed to ongoing nasty behavior by Debbie, but I held my own. Whenever her attorney would write a letter condemning me for decisions made during visitation, like failing to return home old ratty play clothes, I would personally respond to her attorney in writing. I knew she would get the bill, and that gave me some satisfaction. Her attorney eventually stopped sending frivolous letters to our house after Mark hand-delivered a letter to his office threatening to report him to the Bar Association Ethics Committee. We bought Kimberly her own wardrobe, communicated mostly through attorneys, and were thankful that our families lived in different cities.